We're talking with Paul Bannister, author of Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death, giving us the inside look at the tabloid industry. Paul has had more than his share of run-ins with some major celebrities. I'll ask him about that, go down a laundry list, then we'll open up the phones with your questions. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Paul Bannister, you have hinted that some celebrities go to great lengths to keep the tabloids from getting stories, dirt, nasty, dirty stories about them. I guess you mentioned Oprah in particular, that she's refined it to an art form. Tell me about that.
Oh, Oprah's a very, very intelligent woman, and she keeps very close control up there in Chicago. I understand that even today, if there's a check from to be sent out from Harpo, and it's for $5,000 or more, she signs it. But she was I've been up, on a number of Oprah stories actually, and was fortunate enough to have a couple of contacts inside her organization. But as a, for instance, when she was and Stedman were giving, and probably still are giving, a graduate course at Kellogg University there, every student has to sign a non-disclosure agreement. They can't even talk about the coursework, much less what goes on in the classes. Very, very, very keeps the cards very close to her chest.
It seems like we read an Oprah story in some celebrity publication almost every week. She must obviously sells a lot of papers, whether the stories are true or not.
She does. What tends to happen, George, is that somebody will give the tabloids a tip, a hint of a story. It doesn't matter what it is. It might be that Oprah said, oh, she's worried about her weight or whatever it is. And then they will take that little bit and inflate it and spin it. And suddenly you've got a story. It's candy floss, but there's a little bit of sugar there that makes it. It's a formula that works quite well because they can take a gossip item from a New York paper and what would really only merit a paragraph, by the time they finish just teasing it out and putting in some old material around it and padding it, they've got a page one, a headline. And it's what disturbs me actually now with the celebrity tabloids, with the way that they've gone celebrity, is that they mislead the reader time after time. They'll put up, Obama's sex secrets, and it turns out to be some pretty unreliable person who claims to have had homosexual sex with him. Even though the guy is obviously not credible, they'll run it because he's taking responsibility for the story. So, well, we're just reporting it, We're not making this up.
You mentioned that stories about death or impending death or the last days of celebrities are pretty good, and an example of that is and it's another Oprah story, how carefully she has planned for her own funeral.
What she's done is it's almost a hobby with her. She's made a video which will be shown at her own funeral, and she's going to be the star of the show. She's picked out the casket, the gravesite flowers, the music. She's even picked out the perfume she's going to wear to the grave. But the post-mortem video appearance is going to be pretty damn good. It's going to be goodbye girl performance, goodbyes, Motown music. And what she does is, in fact, I got a couple of direct quotes from it. He said she's saying, "If you think this is weird, imagine how it feels for me to be making this tape." And she makes a joke about being cancelled. And the pals are saying, well, it's either cool or it's creepy. She's going to choreograph the whole thing. She's documented her life, and she's put it in order, and she's put it in onto video, and then she's giving these farewell messages, this whole long list of people. They just have to make one big change. She intended being buried rather at the farm in Indiana, but she sold that now, so I doubt that that will happen. And she'd gone to some considerable lengths to get permission to be buried there because, the county doesn't allow you to bury anybody just anywhere.
You say in the book, you mentioned that the last days of blank is sort of a formula that always works and sells a lot. You mentioned Patrick Swayze. I think the Clint Eastwood has been a focus of this, Doris Day. Tell me
Doris
about
Day, week after week, George, you must have seen that. Week after week, so tragic last days of, and then you just fill it, write it on the dotted line.
you need a photo to go with that, though.
It's a hard one with some of the celebs, especially if they're older. I mean, Doris lives in Carmel Valley, and one occasion they said go down there. She's crazy about dogs, of course, and she has about a dozen of them living in the house with her. Just spent $300,000 or $400,000 renovating it to make it more dog friendly. But they sent me to the door one time with a car load of dog food for her. Of course, she doesn't answer the door. Housekeeper does all that. But no, Doris doesn't really come out, and I personally have made about 5 visits down there to try and get stuff, and you go and talk to people, and she still has an interest in the Carmel Valley Inn that she and her son used to operate. She still owns it.
The Patrick Swayze example that you use in the book.
Yeah, that was a sad little story, actually. And actually, it reflects on religious people here. The tabloids wanted to get their readers to pray for Swayze. And he's a good man, or he was. And so they asked me, and said, find somebody who can, you know, put together a prayer for Patrick. And so I went to all the usual suspects, all the televangelists. Everybody, you know, from Billy Graham, well, it's not Billy Graham now, it's his son, on down through, you know, the Crystal Cathedral people. If they even bothered to speak to me, which most of them didn't want to do, they said no. And I couldn't get one single, not even the parish priest or the priest at the school where Swayze went as a boy. All we wanted them to do was to put together a little simple prayer. We'd print it and ask the readers to pray for him. In the end, I did actually get a prayer from, there's a prayer group in Hollywood, and therefore it's an actor's prayer group, and they call them prayer warriors. They have about 5,000 prayer warriors, and they actually did very nicely put together a prayer for Patrick, and we ran it. And it might have helped. He survived another year.
I want to mention one other example because it is as illustrative of the extent to which you and the paper were willing to go to get a story. It's Tony Curtis, who spent several years here in Las Vegas. I got to interview him a couple of times and met him, and you went to great lengths to get an inside story on him.
Yes, he checked into a drying out facility in Pasadena, and I got a call, that he was in there, and go down, and they instructed me. I was on staff at the time, and they said, go down and check in as a patient. I said, how do I get into a psychiatric facility? Don't answer that. I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left me before we met, you know. So I went, I called a psychiatrist who was a friend, and he said, well, just tell him you're strung out. So I did, and I checked in, and they said, don't bring a car. Well, I wasn't going to spend a lot of time sitting around waiting. So I left a car outside and climbed in and out over the wall so I could go into Pasadena in the evenings instead of sitting in my room meditating. And I talked to people and did my observations. And poor old Tony was limping up and down there with nurses supporting him. And every day his chauffeur would arrive and take him off for the day and bring him back for the night. And finally, when I got my story together on how he was doing, I packed everything, climbed over the wall, packed my car, climbed back in again, went, knocked on his door, and he said, come in. I go in, and he said, well, doctor, what do you want? I said, I'm not a doctor. I'm from the National Enquirer. And he levitated, and he came racing at me. Well, I play rugby, and I'm not a small person. And I said, you don't really want to do that. And he turned around and ran back to the phone, and then the whole thing, it was like somebody kicked over a beehive.
Like Red Alert inside the hospital.
It's the tannoy going, Dr. Finkelbein, Dr. Stuthlon. So I went to the desk and said, I'd like my bill now. And they said, well, hang on a minute. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So I left and called them once I got safely away. And they said, it's you, go away.
Let's take a couple of calls. John in Columbus, Ohio, on the wildcard line. Good morning, John.
Hello. Paul and George, how y'all doing?
How's it going?
Sound like the Beatles.
All right. I was just calling. I saw a chair of death on an unsolved mystery. Uh-huh. And I was just curious if there's ever been a woman that died in the chair.
Yeah, I believe there were several.
Okay. And,
yeah, I don't think it's sex specific.
Okay. And the only other thing I was wondering, I think you may have said it before, but did you have an exact number of deaths that were contributed to the sitting in the chair at all?
It's really difficult because the murderer was hanged in 1702, and nobody really kept sort of a baseball score on it. So
okay.
We've only really been able to sort of document it since the, you know, 1940s or 50s.
And what's the ballpark figure since then?
It's in the dozens.
Well, the only other question I have is if you did go to the museum to look at the chair, would they let you photograph it or just touch it with your hand?
I don't know about touching it, but they certainly let you photograph it. It's hung on the wall. And it has, it's not, I said a chain, it's actually a rope that's across it. So it's got arms. It's an armchair, a wooden armchair, the high back.
Okay.
It's hung on a wall up high, so you can't sit in it. And they refuse to take it down off the wall. It's all true. In the Thirsk Museum, if you look, I'll tell you what, I'm a shameless plug again. If you look up my website, there's a picture of the thing. And the website's bannisterbooks.com.
We have a link on the Coast to Coast site.
Oh, that's excellent. Sorry, George, I'd forgotten that. Yeah. If you look on the Coast to Coast website and you can link to it, there's a picture of the chair. And it's a very rare picture, it happens, because it was unguarded. They were renovating the museum. They took it down and took a picture of it actually on the ground with no rope across it. But right now, it's up there, and the museum have their own website, and you can see it in a couple of pictures from their website.
I would imagine if it were in this country that they would keep it up on the wall, not let anybody touch it or sit in it because of a liability concern. Somebody would file a lawsuit if they died, even if it's 10 years later. John, thanks for the call. We're going to Josie in Richmond, Virginia on the wild card line. Hi, Josie.
Hi, y'all. I just wanted to tell you two things before I go into the fact that my husband worked for Gene Pope. One is that Obama's parents or grandparents could have put the announcement in the newspaper after he was born, and they could have said whatever they wanted to say about where he was born, and apparently two different hospitals. And the other thing, the oddity, is that when he was in Illinois, they got expunged the records that were, I mean, the records were supposed to be expunged of this man that was running against Obama, as I recall, either for state or federal office.
Mm-hmm.
And they got this thing undone. Here, a divorce case where both parties wanted this records thoroughly buried and no more talk about it, and they got some scandal attached to it, and he lost the race, and that's how Obama got in. So it's really odd that he himself would go to such lengths to hide every single record he ever had. But anyway, going on from to Gene Pope, my husband, who used to have some papers in Chicago and that sold them and was in between and betwixt, and Gene Pope made him the typical offer you can't refuse from an Italian, but not really that kind of, but a very generous offer with all sorts of little quirks, perks, and so on. So he was hired to run the paper, not to be a reporter, anything of that nature, but to run the paper. Well, when he got down there, he very quickly found out Gene just couldn't let it go. He just had to control everything. So what you said about the control issue
was definitely
there. And also, Jim saw that it was like a revolving door of people being fired. And so Jim did not want to end up being one fired, so he just took advantage of his severance package. I don't know if you knew him or ran into Jim
Lennon. What was his second name, Josie?
Jim Lennon, yes.
Jim Lennon?
Yes. And he was only there for a few months, starting in 76.
I was there then. I have a vague memory, but I can't.
He wasn't there very long, so he may have remembered. But he was. He just decided after, I think he was there maybe in the fall, maybe when he stopped working there, or maybe he started working there in the fall and stopped somewhere close to Christmas. But anyhow, it was not a long tenure. He saw Gene, and we went by his house. And in those days when things were not geared up with security, this house looked like a fortress.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, it was.
He had security guards who would sit all day on the seawall just in case, just in case there was a mob hit coming in up the beach,
right.
I think.
I mean, very weird to go by there and see it, but I thought that would, be of interest that people might like to see that, and so that's why I called.
And it's very kind of you to do that because you substantiated what I'm saying.
It got us out of Chicago and down to Palm Beach, which is rather nice.
winters anyway.
Right.
Thanks,
indeed.
Josie. You have a story in the paper, in the book about Dog the Bounty Hunter. You got to know him pretty well.
Reasonably. I never met him face-to-face at the end of it. No, we talked, and he was... It was a sad story in a way because... He wasn't very well known when I first started to do stories about him, and I did a couple for the tabloids here, and I did a couple for a couple of very nice, upmarket magazines in the UK. And he was very grateful, and he said, "Brother, you've done this for me," and he prayed for me on the phone, and we went through that. But then the Enquirer ran a story; they bought a tape from one of his relatives, I think it might have been one of his sons, in which he used racial epithets, and that soured his relationship with all the tabloids, and he won't, he just wouldn't come back to me. I mean, the last contact I had with him, he sent me some snapshots of him with, not Osmond, oh, drat, I can't think of the fella's name now, a rock musician, an old rock musician. Sharon...
Ozzy Osbourne.
Ozzy Osbourne.
Right.
That came a long way out of left field, didn't it? So he sent me snapshots. Here's Ozzy and Sharon, and we're having a good time in Hawaii. And then he won't answer my calls because the papers did what they so often do, and they polluted their own drinking water, you know?
You had written a story about him going down to Mexico to
get Luster, the kidnapper there, the dreadful, the heir to the Max Factor fortune, who was date raping people, and I had to get that story without Dog's cooperation, but I did get it actually, and it worked well.
And did that help make him a star? Get him?
Oh no,
TV
he was
show?
A star long before that. He was a star before that.
And Bob Hope, not a great impression of Bob Hope.
Bob was an Englishman as well. It's a bit of a letdown. The Queen was very disappointed in that. I went to see him in Burbank. Went to his house in Burbank, and he was there was no particular story I was going for. I went to interview him and see what we could find. Fishing expedition, and it was droning on the way I'm doing now. about how he stayed healthy and what he ate for breakfast, and then suddenly he'd tell the most brilliant, funny story. Absolutely perfect timing. Just out of the blue. It's just part of his act. He'd drop it in, and then he'd go back to being boring and droning on. Anyway, I crossed tracks later because he had adopted a daughter, a little girl, and when she was in her teens, he and she had a falling out, and she's still living in a converted garage in Walnut Creek, California. And she and her daughter, so that's Bob's granddaughter, whom he never saw, were living in poverty.
So he's, at the time, is probably close to a billionaire.
He absolutely was. Bob owned great swathes of property in California. He was a very shrewd businessman.
We're talking with Paul Bannister, author of Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death. More of your calls here on Coast to Coast AM when we come back. Our enterprising webmaster, Lex, just dug up a story on the chair of death, this one from the Weekly World News. I got a feeling they might have borrowed a little material from our guest, Paul Bannister. This one claims 67 lives since 1702. This man dared to sit in cursed seat and became victim number 62, and they have a photo of the guy with sunglasses. I'll ask Paul about that when we come back and get to as many of your questions as we can right after this on Coast to Coast. Paul Bannister is my guest. He's the author of Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death, East of the Rockies, Dennis in St. Louis. Good morning, Dennis.
Oh, good morning to you both. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
One thing I always found out about the tabloids was that they would always print the stories that the mainstream was afraid to print.
You know? Well, yeah. Sort of like what Coast to Coast does.
Indeed. Oh, yeah, true enough. True enough. Has anybody ever thought of partnering up with one of these tabloids, like Coast to Coast, having a partnership or something?
Paul, has National Enquirer ever done a TV version of what they
do?
The
Enquirer had a TV show, but again, it was celebrity. It was mostly celebrity. I don't think they carry very many investigative stories. I mean, you're an investigative reporter yourself, George, so you know what these things are. In fact, you're a very, very well-known one. No, I think all that they've done in the last few years is focus on becoming a celebrity sheet.
It's a tough time to compete against all the other venues, the internet, I would imagine, just like any other published or print media, that those papers are suffering.
Yeah, people aren't reading a great deal. They get their celebrity fix from TV shows. And that's why they're hurting so much. That's why these papers are hurting. I mean, you've got to look at it that back when they were really doing well, they had 80 some reporters on staff and a few hundred freelancers working for them. And right now, the Enquirer is down to a bureau in Los Angeles of a few people there, four or five people, and two staff reporters in Florida.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's quite a change. First-time caller Paul in Santa Barbara. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I just had a couple of quick questions. I was wondering if the Enquirer did any investigation into the death of Princess Diana. They had any, other explanation or theory. And the anthrax attack, I think, on the Enquirer down in Florida. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering about those two things.
On the Diana death, I mean, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories, and Fayed, of course, the father of Dodie Fayed, has long held that the British royal family were behind it because they didn't want to see the one-time Princess of Wales marry, somebody who wasn't from their own circle, as it were. And I think, well, we all know that marriage went bad pretty quickly. It was probably Charles' fault. I mean, I've met Charles on two occasions. I shared a sardine with him once, another story. But Charles really didn't put himself into that marriage. I mean, he was with Camilla the whole time that he and Diana were married.
Did you work the Diana death story?
No, I did not. I actually, after her death, not long after, I got a call from the UK from a friend there who'd made contact with a couple of soldiers who had filmed inside the SAS training center in Hereford. And what they'd done very cleverly was video a wall of photographs that the SAS run this. They have a training center to which celebrities go, and they train them what will happen if they're kidnapped. This is what will happen if special forces come in to rescue you. And they have a special building which is lined about 9 inches thick, I understand, with rubber, so it absorbs the force of live firing bullets. And they come in and they let off a few flashbangs, and then they do some live firing inside there while they rescue the celebrity from the terrorists. And it's to get them used to it. Now, Charles had been through this before, The squaddies knew what was going on, and they took photographs of Di during the exercise, as well as during her little tour, with her two sons around the place. And these pictures are on a wall. It's kind of a wall of fame, the various people have been through it. And these two soldiers videotaped it and offered to sell the Enquirer the pictures. Well, one of these pictures is very illuminative. It shows Charles sitting back laughing, and Di has got her hands up to her ears, and she's terrified because somebody's firing, you know, an AK or whatever, an automatic rifle, within about 2 feet of her head, firing it past her. And he knew what was coming, and he was obviously enjoying seeing, you know, his wife's sprite.
Oh man!
I mean, can you believe that? Would you not sort of sympathize with her on that?
Is there a point at which even the tabloids won't go? For example, you mentioned the biggest issue of all time might have been Elvis, an Elvis issue. I don't know if that you meant that was the Elvis photo in the casket, or
yes, that's exactly it. What happened there was, you know, they really wanted a picture. They wanted the last picture of Elvis, and that was the biggest selling Enquirer ever. So the I didn't go to Memphis on that story. I was in Montana. I was doing something else, but I actually worked on it in the office. And we put 18 reporters into Memphis, right there and then, photographers, reporters, and they took with them a lot of money and a few dozen small cameras, and handed them out. And for $18,000, one of Elvis's relatives took the picture that appeared on the cover. But that wasn't the only picture that was taken. The other, about five other relatives also showed up with pictures that they'd been, you know, taken with the Enquirer issued cameras. But only one, the best one, was sold. You know, the best one was bought by the Enquirer. And the operation cost the Enquirer about $75,000 that week to put the guys in and gather up what they had to gather up and pay off who they had to pay off. And it sold 7 million copies.
You ever see a photo that, you know, of a celebrity or some death scene or funeral that that the paper said, no, that's just too far, that's crossing a line?
It's really a little bit out of my area, to be honest, George. That's the photo, you know, photo desk's
right.
Job. I think they were offered pictures of Diana dead in the Mercedes.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think they ran them. I'm sure they didn't run them. Because what happens is these pictures have to be sold through a supermarket. And they're conscious of the families come through. And you can't, you know, you can't have the really raunchy or shocking pictures there.
We're going to go to our wild card line, Jan in Brooklyn. Jan, you've called us before, haven't you?
Hi. Yeah, hi, George. A quick comment and two questions. That chair might have demonic entities attached to it, and that's going to the people and killing them. Also, I'd like to know, John Binet, do you have any information about who killed her, and also any more information about Natalie Wood? Did she have an argument that night with her husband or something?
Well, John Binet, I do know about a little bit about, because I was there 2 days after the murder. I was in Colorado straight away, in Boulder. It's still not resolved who killed her. There's a lot of suspicion did get attached to the family. John Ramsey polluted the crime scene by finding the child's body and removing the tape and carrying her upstairs and so on. She was bound with cord that was found that came from the house. It came from her own home, and there's no question about that, because a piece of the same cord was found in the family's vacation home up in Michigan somewhere. The suspicion was that she was killed with a golf club. She had scarring. Internal scarring that indicated that she'd maybe been involved in adult practices that had gone on before, and the way she
you
was
mean
bound,
sexual
yes, and the way she was bound indicated that it might have been part of a sexual game. But the family, the other thing was the ransom note was a long, rambling ransom note that was left in the house. And the ransom that was demanded was, I think, $118,000, and it was the exact amount of John Ramsey's annual bonus he just learned about a couple of weeks before.
Do you think you know who did it?
I don't want to be sued for libel.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to name the name,
but
you think you know?
Yeah, I think I know who did it, yeah.
And there just isn't quite enough to nail the person.
No, there've been many books about it, a lot of research into it, but there's not enough evidence, forensic evidence to actually pin it on the killer.
Jan's second question dealt with Natalie Wood. Did you work that one?
No, I did not. No, Robert Wagner, wasn't it? Didn't she go off the boat
and Christopher Walken was there.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't the drinking involved that night?
Yeah, I believe so.
Could have been.
Jan, sorry we can't help you on that one. Thanks for the call. Annie in Houston, Texas. Good morning.
Yes, I'd like to ask him if he thought during the O.J. Simpson trial was a turning point for the Inquirer, because all of a sudden you saw mainstream news anchors start quoting from the Inquirer, and I thought I'd never live to see the day to see that happen.
Thank you, Annie. Well, it's true. The Inquirer actually beat the mainstream media at their own game. Absolutely. I mean, if it weren't for the Inquirer and the shoes... in fact, oddly enough, there was a fellow, Pablo Fengivis, who heard noise. He was a neighbor who heard noise that night, and he was an ex-Inquirer reporter, staff reporter. He was there when I was there. Pablo testified at the trial.
Does the Inquirer have an advantage over stuffier, stodgier mainstream news media in a story like John Binet or something like that, where you go out and just pay somebody? Whereas somebody like NBC News...
People will talk for a big check. Yes, of course they do.
And somebody like NBC News, at least, say they won't do it.
Well, they say they won't. What do they do? They'll fly you back to New York and put you in a nice hotel suite for two nights, you know?
Or call you a consultant?
That too, maybe. I've never been in the happy position of receiving those favors, but I don't think that... although here's a little one. The Good Morning America had a row not so long ago because they were bringing somebody back from a bad fire in Los Angeles, and they chartered. She couldn't be got back to New York in time for the show without they chartered a plane, and they spent $50,000 on the plane to fly her back to New York in time. And then the woman actually wasn't well enough to go, and they had a row within GMA about who actually should pay for it. But that indicates that they're willing to spend money on stories, so who knows?
So holier than thou may not always apply. West of the Rockies, Greg in Long Beach. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. I was wondering if you knew about any celebrities that are occultists or Freemasons. It seems like I've seen pictures of some of them wearing like Masonic rings, like Brad Pitt and George Clooney and people like that. I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
Oh, I like that question.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you.
Does that mean you have information and can't say?
I just don't have that information. I just don't know. We all know about Travolta and his Scientology, and the others. You know, Cruz with his. To me, they're cults. But I don't know of specifics on people who might be out, demon worshipping or whatever.
Have you ever chased the Scientology stuff? Because that's a formidable adversary in a lot of ways.
It is indeed, and the German government are taking them on, aren't they?
For journalists though, they'll come after you. You publish something they don't like.
That's right. That's right. They will. They will.
And so, did you ever go on that one?
I never had a Scientology story that I needed to do. I'm not being evasive on that. It's never risen, you know. I've been threatened by a New Jersey mob hitman, but he's dead now, so I'm probably safe.
I've been threatened by some mafia guys myself. Rob, east of the Rockies, Rob in Knoxville, Tennessee. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. I was just wondering, I can't understand why that a lot of the celebrities, instead of going along with maybe the Inquirer and granting interviews, that they're so evasive, of their fame. And that's always been a question I've had, because it seemed like to me that if you don't want to, have something put out there about you that may be half true or whatever, partially true, that you would actually, invite, like this gentleman here into your home and actually have a sit down with him and talk with things, It's sort of like Joan Crawford. I think she probably was put in a worse light than what she probably was in reality. And I'll get off here in a minute, but I was going to ask you, Elvis seems to be, you touched on him a minute ago, seems to be the biggest story, I mean, that the Inquirer had there for a while. He was just front page news for years and years and years, like a decade or so. And it just amazed me, the longevity of him, as opposed to maybe Michael Jackson, you know. Elvis seemed to be just a marketable person for a lot of different things, you know. And thank you all.
I think at that time, people were still admiring celebrities a lot more. You know, Michael Jackson got to be very contentious, didn't he? You know, where people were very, they were quite suspicious of his relationships and so on. But Elvis never had any particular opprobrium attached to him. He was never really a villain in any way, was he?
Well,
he was always popular.
Yeah, I would think everyone would agree with that.
No, there was no scandal about Elvis particularly. I mean, all right, he put some weight on, and at the end, it was unfortunate he died when he did. But it wasn't that, you know, you had sex scandals around him, or he was, you know, hand in the till or anything.
Well, there were certainly scandals that came out long after his death about sex and drugs and things of that sort.
Yeah, but I mean, while he was still alive, often we have to wait until they die before we find out the truth, don't we?
I'll try to slip one more call in. Matt in Ohio on the first-time caller line. Better make it quick. Matt?
Okay, it's great talking to you, George.
Thanks.
Paul, I was wondering if the Inquirer ever got into the story about that guy in the tree man. There's YouTube videos out there of...
The Filipino man with the terrible growth on his body.
Yeah, that guy.
I don't think that's an Inquirer story for the as it happens. That might work for the National Examiner, perhaps. But it doesn't make their mix anymore.
Oh, okay. So it is real, though? It's not.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it's real. You've seen that one, George?
I have not, no.
There's a man with terrible growth, and it looks like he's got bark instead of skin. It's a medical condition.
I've seen Wolf Boy and Lizard Man, but never Tree Guy.
Nice people they were.
Hey, Matt, thank you for the call. Paul, talk to me for a moment. We have about a minute left about the future of the tabloid industry. I mean, I guess there'll always be a place for this kind of subject matter, but I guess the question is which media delivers it.
That's a good question. They're struggling. I mean, the American media, which owns all the tabloids now, is the best part of $1 billion in debt. The tabloids themselves are making a bit of money every week, but they're not making enough to service that debt to pay the interest on it. So I think what we might see soon is maybe they're going to get sold off to somebody who can make them work. But it's like the whole of the industry is in transition with television and the internet. Print media is going to have to change to survive. It's the animal that evolves that survives.
Paul Bannister, thank you very much for a fascinating interview. I hope people will read this book, Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death. It's very entertaining. And thanks for being with us, everyone. And thank you, Paul, for being with us as well.
Thank you, George. It's been an absolute pleasure for me.
All right. Thanks to my two Jasons there at Premier Radio. I'll be back Friday night with an open line show, and then next Sunday with my guest, Maurice Cotterell. Good night, everyone.